Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 15th, 2006. Our session today is titled Israel and Palestine Today, The Facts on the Ground. Our presenter is Charles P. Lutz. Session number LUC 2006-2. Let's listen in.
We will begin. The topic today is the last century in Israel-Palestine, a century of conflict. And what I'd like to do is a very quick review of the last 100 years and how that has brought us to where we are today in that part of the world and in really world global politics, international politics in relation to the Israel-Palestine reality. I'll also conclude with a little bit of look at the electoral change that happened in earlier this year in both Israel and Palestine and what that promises for a future just peace, for good or ill. And then we'll have a quick look at the new violence that has broken out in both Gaza and Lebanon in more recent months, and a closing word about peace prospects in the future. And for that, I hope you'll join in the discussion and share what you feel, what you sense, what you see. And if there's time, we'll show about a 22-minute video produced by the Mennonite Central Committee on the present reality on the ground for the Palestinians in the occupied territories, particularly in the West Bank, with the building of the wall, the building of more and more Israeli settlements in the West Bank, military occupation and the checkpoints and all of that, how that affects the Palestinian people in their daily lives. So let's begin with a word of prayer. God, we thank you for this opportunity again to be in conversation about the land that we call holy, about the land where you came among us in human history in the form of Jesus. We thank you for the people who are gathered to give attention to that topic, and we invite your presence and the presence of the Holy Spirit as we engage in discourse together. In Jesus' name, amen. The last century in that part of the world, what we have long called the Holy Land, from the Mediterranean to the sea, and what has been for many centuries actually called Palestine, which is a Latin term for Philistia, the land of the Philistines, basically the land that we saw pictured on maps in our Sunday school days. From the Mediterranean to the Jordan River, and from today's border with Syria and Lebanon in the north, and down to the sea, down to the Sinai and the sea at the bottom end of the state of Israel. It's been a century of conflict and of evolving political realities based on decisions made by the international community, the League of Nations. Then, well, at first the World War I led to significant change. Then the League of Nations decision to give the territory to the Brits as a mandate to lead toward self-determination by the people who were there. And that led to a decision by the United Nations in 1947 to create the State of Israel and to partition the land for, in effect, for two peoples to occupy it. And then I'll go quickly through the development of various peace processes in the last two or three decades in which the United States has played a lead role. In fact, there are many who believe that the United States continues to be the chief actor in any process that might lead to a just peace in that territory, in that area, because of our influence. Our influence as a superpower, but also our significant influence with the State of Israel as its kind of patron or champion or defender, protector in all of the international settings. So let's begin with the rise of Zionism. The rise of Zionism really began emerged as a concept, as an idea, creating somewhere in the world a state, a homeland for the Jewish people, which they could identify with as their homeland, and which Jews anywhere in the world, whether or not they went there, could identify as their homeland. That came through in the late 19th century through the writings of a man named Herzl, H-E-R-Z-L, and it really was a way of trying to deal with the reality of persecution of Jews in Europe primarily, and the anti-Semitism of their settings in not only Germany but France, England, wherever they were in Poland, all over in Europe. The concept was initially very secular. It was not a religious ideology that Herzl was expounding. It was defining Jews in terms not of religious faith, but in terms of ethnicity. Jewish ethnicity was the key. And the original idea behind Zionism was opposed by the ultra-Orthodox in the Jewish community, because they said, no, there can be a homeland for the Jews only when the Messiah comes. It has to be part of the Messianic age. And that hasn't yet happened, and therefore they opposed it. That has changed significantly. Religious Jews today are, I think, among the more extreme defenders of the right of Israel, or of Jews, to have all of the land from the river to the sea. And we'll talk more about that tomorrow. But initially, Zionism was a secular idea. It was a secular concept. In 1917, and Zionism, for some reason, became centered and lodged in the United Kingdom, in London. That's where its headquarters was by this time, and that's where the main activity was. And Lord Balfour, who was the foreign minister of the United Kingdom in 1917, issued this statement. He said, Her Majesty's government view with favor the establishment, I guess it was His Majesty's government at that time, view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. What is often forgotten is the rest of that statement, which said, the call for a Jewish homeland was qualified with these words, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. That part of it was often neglected, and I think, in a sense, to this day, it's neglected by the world community. The Zionist movement then gained new strength with the defeat of the Ottoman Empire in 1917. Actually, before the end of World War I, the Ottoman Turks, who were allied with Germany and the other powers on I guess they called it the Central Powers, on that side of World War I, they lost. And the Ottoman Empire fell already before the end of the war in 1918. It fell in 1917. The Ottoman Turks had been ruling the Holy Land for 400 years, exactly 400 years, from 1517, and Lutherans can remember that because it's the date of the launching of the Reformation, as Lutherans see it, the posting of the 95 Theses. From 1517 to 1917, the Ottoman Turks, based in Istanbul in Turkey, were running things. And that area was simply a kind of a province of the Turkish Empire, which included Syria and what is now Lebanon and many other parts of the Iraq, Jordan. All of that was part of the Ottoman Turkish Empire. So the Turks lost control of that territory. And after the war ended in 1918 and into 1919 with the Treaty of Versailles and the meetings in Versailles to fashion a new world order, the Brits were given a mandate to, in effect, become the new colonial power in that region, and under the mandate from the League of Nations were to prepare the peoples of that area for self-governance and for, you know, nationhood. The Brits also got what is today Jordan, then called Transjordan, across the Jordan, the Kingdom of Jordan. Today they got Iraq, and the French got, as a mandate under the League of Nations, what? Lebanon and Syria, yeah. And that's why, to this day, there's still significant French influence, and the French foreign minister was part of the effort in the United Nations Security Council in past recent weeks to prepare a resolution calling for a ceasefire and deployment of an international police force in South Lebanon, along with the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. So the French continue to have the influence there, even though they are no longer the governing power. They're no longer in charge, but they are still influential. As the British, for all those years between the two world wars, were extremely influential in what developed in the Holy Land. The mandate period, well, let me share one more thing I'd like to quote. This is, I think, fascinating. I had never known this until I read this book, The Complete Palestine, which is about the British mandate period, written by an Israeli historian. At one point in the discussions at Versailles, the United States, through Woodrow Wilson, President Woodrow Wilson, who was there, the United States was asked if it would take over the mandate for the Holy Land. And that was very controversial. And one of the reasons it was controversial, and it was finally turned down by Wilson, he said no. But this is an explanation of why it was viewed with disdain by the world Jewish community. In a publication issued by the Zionist organization in London, titled Democracy in America, this is what was written. Democracy in that sense in America has been called the melting pot in which that quantitatively lesser, that which is quantitatively lesser is assimilated into the quantitatively greater, in other words, majority rule. This doubtless is natural in America and works on the whole very well. But if the American idea were applied as an American administration might apply it to Palestine, what would happen? The numerical majority in Palestine today is Arab, not Jewish. Qualitatively, it is a simple fact that the Jews are now predominant in Palestine, in the view of this writer. Qualitatively, the Jews were predominant, but quantitatively, on a one-man, one-vote approach, they would be in the minority. And given proper conditions, they will be predominantly, quantitatively, also in a generation or two. But if the crude arithmetical conception of democracy, one man, one vote, one person, one vote, were to be applied now or at some early stage in the future to Palestinian conditions, the majority that would rule would be the Arab majority. And the task of establishing and developing a great Jewish Palestine would be infinitely more difficult. So the concept in the Zionist ideology from the beginning was a Jewish state. And to this day, Israel is self-identified as a Jewish state. It has non-Jewish citizens. About 20% of the 6.5 million Israelis are non-Jewish, but it is consciously and intentionally a Jewish state, not a kind of melting pot where anybody has equal rights as in the United States. Okay. So all through the British Mandate period, from 1919 is when it began, to 1947, there was an influx, continuing influx of Jews from around the world, and particularly after World War II. But it didn't begin then. It began even earlier in the century. And they would settle in areas where there was land available. They built cities along the seacoast. Tel Aviv really was built during that period from nothing. There'd been a small Arab community called Jaffa, just to the south of where Tel Aviv is. But Tel Aviv really grew up in the 20th century. by recently emigrated Jews. And so they basically settled in areas where there was not large Arab presence, and they lived together reasonably well, at peace, during that period. But there was growing concern in the Arab community, what we would today call Palestinian community, about what was going to happen there and whether their rights would be respected. Finally, in November of 47, the United Nations declared that there should be a partition of the land into an Israeli state and a, I don't know if they use the language state, but an area for Arabs. And they set that apart. It was 55% of the total territory of Palestine, mandate Palestine for the Israelis, and 45% for the Palestinians. Immediately there was war. The Israeli state was officially declared in the spring of 48. But even before that, and certainly for about a year after that, there was fighting. All of the Arab states around Palestine went to war against Israel. They did not accept the creation of an Israeli state, and they said they were going to try to wipe it out, push the Jews into the sea. That was the position officially of the Arab states surrounding Israel. The result of that in terms of land politics was that at the end of the hostilities in 48-49, Israel controlled 78% of Mandate Palestine, and the Arab communities had 22%. And the area that we today know as the Gaza Strip went under Egyptian governance. The area we know as the West Bank went under, and East Jerusalem, which has always been Arabic, eastern half of Jerusalem, went under Jordanian governance. And that lasted until 1967, when the so-called Six-Day War happened. And again, there's historians dispute whether the Six-Day War was started by the Arabs or whether it was precipitated by Israel doing certain things, occupying territory that hadn't been part of Israel. Who is to blame for starting that war is in dispute. But there was a Six-Day War. Again, the Arabs lost. And Israel then took over control of Gaza, also Sinai, the Sinai region of Egypt, and the Golan Heights, part of Syria, up above the Sea of Galilee, and the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. And in fact, incorporated legally or officially East Jerusalem into Israel proper. It has never incorporated Gaza or Golan or the West Bank into Israel proper, but has continued to occupy it for almost 40 years. The longest occupation of one people by the military of another, the military occupation of, by another people in the last millennium, certainly. And that continues to be the issue. How can the occupation be ended and Israel be moved out of? How can permanent borders be established? How can the rights of the Palestinian to self-determination be established? So you've got that consequence of the Six-Day War, the United Nations right after the Six-Day War in the early fall of 1967 adopted Security Council Resolution 242, which continues to this day to be the baseline of the international community's argument for a peaceful settlement between Israel and Palestine. And let me read that to you, the key pieces of it. It's very brief. It called for these three things: withdrawal of Israel armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. Secondly, termination of all claims or states of belligerency and respect for and acknowledgement of the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence of every state in the area and their right to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries, free from threats or acts of force. And thirdly, a just settlement of the refugee problem. That's been a kind of festering, fermenting wound ever since 1948. what to do with and what are the rights of the Palestinian refugees who either fled or were forced out of Israel proper, and who continue to be, most of them, living in the region, although I've met some in the Twin Cities of Minnesota who are officially classified as Palestinian refugees under international understanding. They're in Lebanon, they're in Syria, they're in Jordan. Many of them emigrated to Jordan and are living there permanently. They're in camps within the West Bank and Gaza. There were about 700,000 at the time of the 1948 chaos. There are today, counting their descendants to the second and third and maybe even fourth generation, they're officially classified as refugees as well, over 4 million. What to do with them? The international law recognizes that after a conflict ends, people who went into refuge during the conflict or because of it have a right to return to their country of origin. Israel has said absolutely not. They will never accept back, certainly not any significant number of refugees, because it would tip the population to a majority of non-Jews. So you've got the refugee issue to be dealt with, and that may be the toughest of all issues to deal with in any kind of formation of a peaceful resolution of the conflict. Many believe that the only resolution of that issue that's ever going to be accepted by all parties is some kind of financial compensation, with the world community coming up with the money to, in effect, pay off and just render some kind of justice to those who lost their land and their homes in what is now Israel. So that's 242. 242 is referred to in almost all of the proposals that have come along for some kind of peace process. It's under the framework of Resolution 242 that the ongoing discussion happens. Well, what have those discussions led to? There have been some successes in peace processes. In 1979, under Jimmy Carter at Camp David, the first Camp David meeting on the Middle East, Menachem Begin and Anwar Sadat, the leaders respectively of Israel and Egypt, came together, signed a peace agreement. Israel would leave Sinai, which Israel did. It would even take out the rather small number of people, but the Israeli settlers who were in the Sinai. And Israel and Egypt would sign a peace treaty saying that they respected each other and the right to live together in peace, and they established full diplomatic relations between each other. In the Oslo Accords of 1993, so-called because they were formulated in Oslo, Norway, in a kind of secret meeting between Palestinian representatives and Israeli representatives, and then the signing, the ratification of the agreement was on the White House lawn. In 1993, under Bill Clinton, that was to lead to peace talks and negotiation of all of the issues, how to divide Jerusalem, where the final border should be between Israel and Palestine, even what to do about the refugees. The Oslo process never really went anywhere. It didn't accomplish anything. Toward the end of Bill Clinton's term, in 2000, and even into January 2001, his last month in office, he had brought the parties to another Camp David meeting where they were trying to work out a final resolution of the conflict, and it came close, but it didn't finally succeed. And so much of what continues to be talked about as the way to a solution is based on the Oslo Accord and what the Oslo Accord called for. Even though Oslo itself as a process didn't succeed. At the early part of the Oslo process, in 1994, the Kingdom of Jordan and Israel signed a peace agreement. So those two are now officially at peace with each other and supposedly respectful of each other and have full diplomatic relations. But the other surrounding Arab nations, Syria, Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, they have not yet come to that point. The Arab Summit in, I think it was 2003, which is about the time when the quartet's roadmap was being formulated, and I'll say a word about that in a minute. The Arab Summit, all of the Arab nations in their summit, which I think was in Beirut in 2003, said, we will recognize the state of Israel, its right to exist. We will form complete diplomatic relations with the state of Israel if Israel will withdraw from all of the occupied territories and allow a Palestinian state to emerge. So that's officially where the Arab nations now are on record with regard to the conflict. The quartet's roadmap. You know who's in the quartet? Four parties?
France.
No?
No.
European Union, Russia, the United Nations Security Council, and the United States. Those four, in 2003, came out with the roadmap, which was another prescription for a process that was to lead to a peaceful resolution of the conflict. And, you know, it included much of what was in the Oslo Accords. It wasn't a final solution, but it was a kind of a roadmap leading to what was hoped would be a final solution, with the parties, Israel and Palestine, together sitting down at the table and working out compromises wherever there were issues. That hasn't gone anywhere either. And I think one of the reasons it hasn't gone anywhere is the United States government has not pushed it because we became preoccupied with Iraq. And the Israel-Palestine issue went to the back burner. And all the way through this period, the official policy of the United States government was that Israel, while it had to be assured of security and had to be respected within the 1967 borders, had to withdraw from occupied territory and had to stop settling Israelis on occupied, or Jewish Israelis on occupied territory. That was true until George W. Bush, just last year, in a meeting with, I think it was when Sharon was still active and alive and among us, he said, George W. Bush said, he thought that the final resolution had to accept the continuing presence of some of the settlements in the West Bank. At least it was sort of indicating a change in U.S. stance on the issue of the settlements, and by implication, where the final border should be. The other development was in 2005, Sharon accomplished a withdrawal from Gaza, withdrawal of settlements and of Israeli military presence within Gaza. As far as the Gazans were concerned, and the Palestinians generally, it didn't amount to a whole lot because Israel still completely surrounds with military presence and with controlling access from sea, land, and air to Gaza. Israel is in complete control of that. But at least Israel had left, and I think about 8,000 settlers were removed. And it was very controversial within Israel. It wasn't supported by all Israelis. And some of the settlers, I understand, are now being resettled in the West Bank. Some are being resettled within Israel proper. So that happened, and then the question that was asked often after that happened was, is it Gaza first or Gaza last? In other words, will Gaza be the only example of withdrawal from occupied territory by Israel? Why don't I stop there and see if there are any comments, questions, observations you have before we go into the present situation. Anything unclear, anything you want to disagree with, anything you want to ask about?
What percentage of the Palestinians actually are dead set against Israel? Is it all of them, or half of them, or just Hamas?
I've asked Palestinians that, and they usually have said, well, during the period when Hamas was gaining strength as a political reality within the Palestinian society, they would say, well, maybe 30% are with Hamas in not accepting the state of Israel's existence and the right of Israel to exist as a on a part of the land that the two peoples need to share. That a majority of Palestinians accept the state of Israel and are willing to live as a people alongside it in their own state. In other words, supporting a two-state solution to the reality, the conflict. Thus, it was a surprise to many, including, I think, to Hamas itself, that Hamas won a majority of the legislative seats in the Palestinian Legislative Council. I'm told by friends in Palestine that not only did the Palestinians as a whole not expect that, neither did Hamas expect that. And we'll talk a little more about that in a minute. But all of the polling evidence and all of the kind of anecdotal evaluative evidence that you get in talking with Palestinians is that a majority of Palestinians are supportive of two states living side by side in peace and security. And I think that's still true. So what about the elections of this year? Well, Hamas won 65%, I think, of the seats in the Palestinian legislature, to the surprise of just about everybody. Palestinians I've talked to about that say they don't think it's because of Hamas's position on not recognizing the state of Israel and its support of violence. They think it's because Hamas was seen as an honest and honorable political reality within the Palestinian mix, which Fatah was not. Fatah was viewed as corrupt, as ineffective, as not able to deliver social services. It's kind of like Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah is popular with people because they've delivered a lot of social services to Lebanese people. And so with Hamas. Hamas was delivering educational services, health care, running a social order in much of the Palestinian territory that was widely respected. And the theory is that a large number of Palestinians voted for Hamas candidates for that reason, not for reasons of its stance on the state of Israel and the political situation. So you've got that reality, and one result of that is that both the Israeli government and the United States government has said that we will not deal with a government that is led by Hamas. Well, the government, the prime minister, president of Palestinian Authority, is still a Fatah person, Mahmoud Abbas. He's not Hamas. And there have been some meetings and conversations with Abbas, but no real getting back to a peace negotiating table. Also later in 2006, in the spring, the Israeli elections led to the selection of as prime minister, Mr. Olmert, O-L-M-E-R-T, who had been kind of the deputy to Ariel Sharon, and Ariel Sharon, though he's still alive, last I heard he was still alive, is near death, apparently, and has been in a coma for many months, and clearly is never going to return to any kind of power in the political scheme. Olmert then had to put together a coalition to gain a majority in the Knesset, and he has done that. His party is a new party that was really launched by Ariel Sharon last year. What's it called?
Kadima.
And that has drawn a lot of people from the former Likud, from the continuing Likud party, and from other sources. And that's now the leading party in the coalition that has been put together. And it appears that Olmert's victory was based at least in part on his promise that he would, over the next 3 years, gradually withdraw from parts of the West Bank withdraw some of the settlements from scattered parts of the West Bank, and probably keeping those that are close to the 1967 border, but at least would try to lead to some kind of withdrawal and end to the occupation in much of the West Bank. I don't think there's ever been a promise, though, on the part of Israeli political leaders in recent years to share Jerusalem, that is, to let East Jerusalem become part of a Palestinian state. And the Palestinians have always said they want East Jerusalem to be part of a Palestinian state and their capital. And thus, Jerusalem, in that demand, would have to be somehow shared with a line drawn dividing the city into two parts. By the way, the original UN action that created the State of Israel called for Jerusalem to be a kind of international city under some kind of international structure with its holy places available to people of all three faiths and with its civil governance under some international body. But that never happened. Until 1967, West Jerusalem was part of Israel and East Jerusalem was part of the area that the Kingdom of Jordan governed. New violence. Violence broke out in Gaza, when was it, last... in Gaza, was it last fall? Late last year, when there was a capture of an Israeli soldier by the Gazans, and as far as I know, he's still being held, and there was retaliation. There had also been some shooting of rockets out of Gaza into Israel, north of Gaza, over the years, but for the most part, over the last months, but for the most part, Hamas had not been engaged in any kind of military activity or violence against Israel for several years. They had sworn off that, but they didn't say they would forever abandon that the use of violence. But that has now been ended, and the result is that Israeli military has re-entered parts of Gaza, and there's been fighting, and there's been a lot of killing, and that goes on. More recently, that has been pretty much ignored by the world media because of the outbreak of violence in southern Lebanon. And there it was Hezbollah, which is a political faction within Lebanon, which has its own militia, its own army, and not controlled by the central Lebanese government, and has been sending missiles into Israel, into the north of Israel, and doing damage and killing people. And there too, there were I think two Israeli soldiers who were taken captive, and they're still being held by Hezbollah. And Hezbollah said it wanted to keep them and negotiate with Israel for the release of Arab prisoners in Israeli jails. And but it's become really a war in the last month, and the world community is trying to figure out. And when I came up to the village over the weekend, I hadn't yet heard if the resolution in the United Nations Security Council had been passed. I don't know if it has been, but calling for a ceasefire and for the deployment of an international force in the south of Lebanon to presumably not only keep the peace, but also to work with the Lebanese in disarming Hezbollah. And of course, the other side of it would be Israeli withdrawal from the south of Lebanon.
Yeah, ceasefire started Monday morning.
Oh, did it?
And all the refugees are pouring back into their homes.
Why are they?
Jamming in.
Is the ceasefire holding? I mean,
yeah, there weren't any major problems.
Okay.
It was passed on Saturday, and it was drafted by France and the United States.
And the U.S., yeah.
With the knowledge that Israel would assent to it. And if it would assent to it, then the United States would have sent to it. So they had to nuance. This is what I read in the Saturday New York Times here holding today.
Okay.
The language had to be nuanced, from what I understand, to say that Hezbollah had to completely stop the use of violence, and Israel should stop the use of violence except in the case of defensive, something that would be defensive. So it was nuanced in that way.
Okay. So you may want to talk a little more about the present reality in our conversation time. The last thing I just want to lift up, and I don't have much to say, is what are the prospects for peace now? There are, and I've been working on the last 4 or 5 years with a group called Churches for Middle East Peace in Minnesota. It's a nationwide effort of 21 Christian agencies based in Washington, D.C., including the ELCA's Washington office, working on U.S. policy with regard to mainly Israel-Palestine. We hardly ever have gotten involved with Iraq and other issues. It's almost entirely Israel-Palestine. And trying to do lobbying with members of Congress, in my case we do it with Minnesota delegation, and a lot of speaking in local churches, and a lot of work with local, in the Twin Cities area, local Jewish and Muslim groups. But the position of Churches for Middle East Peace is basically to reach a resolution of the conflict and a two-state solution with people living side by side in peace and mutual respect, and really flowing out of Resolution 242 and other international actions, including our own government's positions that have been taking over the years. This is what the goals of CMEP are. We are Christians called to express our concerns for peace in Israel and Palestine. We pray for peace in the Holy Land and urge our country's leaders to do all in their power to prepare the road for a long and lasting peace. We believe that one of the primary outcomes of peace negotiations in the Middle East must be a viable Palestinian state living in peace alongside the State of Israel. For a state of Israel, or for a state of Palestine to be viable, all Israeli settlement activity in the occupied territories must cease. That's kind of ambiguous. It doesn't say all settlements have to be removed. It says all activity must cease, which could mean no future building of settlements. But anyway, that's where it is. We believe in the vision of a shared Jerusalem as the heritage, hope, and home of two peoples and three religions. Jerusalem should be a shared, open city, a sign of peace and a symbol of reconciliation for the Abrahamic faiths. We support a UN-sponsored negotiated agreement for peace and the application of international law in all aspects of an Israeli-Palestinian-Arab peace process. We strongly support a multinational presence of observers in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem as one immediate means of discouraging further violence between Palestinians and Israelis. Much of the world has called for such an international peace presence sent by the governments of the world for many years, but it has always been defeated in the Israeli by Israeli opposition, I think, in the Security Council. The United States has vetoed any such efforts at the encouragement of Israel. There has been an international presence of peace folks from the civil order, not from governments. Christian peacemaker teams would be one example of that. The Ecumenical Accompaniment Program of the World Council of Churches is another, and we'll talk more about that later in the week, and particularly on Thursday evening. So the prospects of peace right now, I think, are pretty dreary because there is no commitment to get back to the negotiating table. And it seems to me, and to, I think, most people who are knowledgeable about the situation, that finally it is not going to be through a military triumph that a resolution of the conflict is achieved, but through a diplomatic agreement. And that hasn't happened. We've had many efforts to move that way over the last couple of decades, but it hasn't yet been achieved. And I think it's probably unlikely to happen until the United States government at the highest authority insists. And the Bush administration has not been willing to do that. And so it may have to wait for another administration in Washington before that, before they get back to the peace table. That's my view. That's my own sense of where we are. So, any more conversation? Yes.
Your group has not addressed the question of Lebanon.
Right, yeah. We haven't addressed that specifically. Cause this comes from earlier when there was really no conflict going on immediately in Lebanon.
Or communication between Hamas and Hezbollah.
Hezbollah?
You haven't addressed.
No, we haven't addressed that. No, what I read, I think, comes from a formulation back in the late 90s. So it doesn't deal at all with the issues of the current political reality in Palestine.
There are regular press releases from Churches for Middle East Peace.
Yeah, Churches for Middle East Peace has addressed the issue of the fallout from the election of Hamas to a majority in the Palestinian legislature, which has, among other things, led to a cutoff in aid to the Palestinian Authority from the United States, Canada, much of the European community, and has said that that is having drastic humanitarian impact on the Palestinian people, because a lot of the money that was going to the Palestinian Authority was turned into education and health care and other social services for Palestinian people. And not only has that been cut off, but the Israeli government, which had been collecting tax revenue that was really the property of the Palestinians, and then remitting it to them on a regular basis, the Israeli government has stopped that. They're not sending those remittances since the election of Hamas.
The Christian group is opposed to that policy.
The what?
The Christian group is opposed to this policy of withholding aid.
Yes, yes. At least is saying that aid has to be routed into service to Palestinian people somehow. If it doesn't go through the Palestinian Authority, let it be done through non-governmental organizations. But somehow it has to be gotten there. And for Lutherans, it has particular effect because Augusta Victoria Hospital on the Mount of Olives, which is operated by the World Lutheran Federation, had been receiving much of its support, not from its clients, the Palestinian people who couldn't afford to pay, but from the Palestinian Authority. And so we're saying, can we at least route that money through non-governmental sources to get to the hospital? And you know, that debate continues, and how to figure that out is still being worked on. And I think there is some progress along that line. But anyway, that's where we are on the issue of Hamas and aid to Palestine.
What is your opinion about the United States' stance against Hamas as a legitimate elected government?
I think it's a mistake. Hamas has been identified by our government for a long time as a terrorist organization. It's on our list of terrorist organizations. And I guess for that reason, and because it, you know, doesn't recognize the state of Israel, we have said we will not deal with Hamas. And we will not deal with a government that is led by Hamas as a majority of the legislative seats. And it's kind of ironic, because the policy of the Bush administration has been to promote democracy in the Middle East. And everyone agrees that the election was entirely fair and legitimate and honest, and the will of the Palestinian people. And now we're saying, no, we won't deal with that government because of the results.
Yeah. Question. I mean, it seems to me, from an Israeli perspective, how do you deal with your neighbor if they say that their goal is to destroy you, that mm-hmm. you have no mm-hmm. right to exist, yeah. that was a made-up country, it has no right to exist? If their fundamental position is that, I don't see how the Israeli government can really deal with them.
Yeah.
They need a fundamental change in that.
Yeah, but see, all through the Oslo period, when Arafat was in charge of the Palestinian Authority, and when there were some peace negotiations going on, culminating in Camp David 2001, the Palestinian government did not say that. They said they were willing to be a state living in peace alongside the state of Israel on recognized borders, and they argued for going back to the 1967 borders. So the failure to reach an agreement back in those years was not because the Palestinian government said we don't recognize Israel or we won't live in peace with an Israeli state. That's a more recent development. And I think even there, if they got to the peace table, I think Hamas would, to the extent that it was part of the conversation and it would have to be involved, I think Hamas would eventually come around.
But to me, I mean, even from another Israeli perspective, they pulled out of Gaza, you know, recently, mm-hmm. and the thanks they got for pulling out was more rocket attacks.
Mm-hmm.
They pulled out of Lebanon in 1982 or thereabouts, and
they went in 82. They pulled out in 2000.
Right, in 2000.
Yeah, in 2000.
But the thanks I thought in southern Lebanon it was more earlier than that. And the Hezbollah used that time to put in many rockets supplied from Iran and Syria,
mm-hmm.
and they built a military base and then launched those missiles into Israel.
Right.
So from an Israeli perspective, I'm just trying to put forth the idea that they did have tried to do some things, and their thanks for that is a stronger military on the other side of the border attacking them.
Part of that is because the United States is not stepping up to the bat in the sense of saying that we're going to go in and we're going to knock this together, try to get everybody to sit down and do what needs to be done. In order for Israel to have a secure northern border, there has to be a secure state of Lebanon that has in control of its territory, that doesn't have a Syrian militia or a Syrian proxy taking control of its southern border.
Right.
And that's where, you know, once Syria was officially pulled out last year, that's where the United States fumbled. We didn't go in and do anything about that. The United States has basically been trying to do its Middle Eastern policy by saying, well, we'll prop up one guy and just hope that it all works out, rather than going in and saying, well, look, we really need to go in and fix this. You know, we're just going to let the Lebanese fight each other for 25 years and then say, well, okay, I guess we can try to, you know, encourage somebody maybe a little bit, but we're not actually going to go in and help them police.
They just need a big settlement there?
Well, right now what they need is somebody to police the area and disarm Hezbollah. But, I mean, that's what's needed. And then whoever's going to do it, and if it isn't going to be the government of Lebanon, there needs to be somebody else going in at the invitation of the government of Lebanon to go in and police the area and make sure that it's not being used as a base for attacks for against Israel or against other places.
And with some kind of strengthening of a government of Lebanon.
Yes.
Which is now
exactly.
Very weak. Yeah.
Yes. Exactly.
Well, another big problem is that Israel continues to hold detainees of both Gazans and Hezbollah and Lebanese detainees that are not charged with crimes. So whenever you hear these, we want you to release your prisoners, really should say the word detainees. Many of them are not even charged with crimes. And that is just, it's a very emotional thing for
us. And they number in the thousands.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're not going to have time to run the tape. Maybe we can run it in a later session or the video. And we do need to close down fairly soon. But are there any other comments or questions that you want to get into the discussion? Yes.
I just was going to say, not everybody is completely monolithic. I mean, you know that.
Indeed.
Just to point out, for instance, that there are large groups of the Hasidic community, Jewish Hasidic community, which are still anti-Israel, even today.
Anti-state of Israel.
Anti-state of Israel,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're absolutely against it even today.
It should also be said that there are significant numbers of Israelis who are very active in a variety of peace efforts.
Yeah.
And that's rarely reported in our media.
Yeah.
We rarely hear of that. A person who's become a good friend of mine from Minnesota named Jeff Halper Minnesota-born Jew from Hibbing, now is an Israeli citizen for maybe the last 30 years, an academic anthropologist. He has formed in recent years a group called the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, which tries to stop his own government, the Israeli government, from demolishing the homes of Palestinians in order to put settlers on them or to build the wall or for whatever reason. He and his group try to stop that. They try to protest, demonstrate against their own government's behavior. And when they fail to stop the demolition, they help the Palestinians to rebuild. That's a group of Israelis who are doing that, standing up for the rights of Palestinians. We don't hear much about that in the U.S. press, and I think that's unfortunate. There are other groups. Rabbis for Human Rights is another such group of Jewish rabbis in Israel who work for and stand alongside in solidarity with Palestinians in olive harvesting and in protesting the wall siting and a variety of ways. And we need to be aware of that. Not all Israelis are supportive of the occupation or of the policies of their own government as it affects Palestinians. And I think that's also true in the American Jewish community. There's a variety of opinion, right?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah. On the behavior of Israel. Well, thank you. Let's talk again tomorrow when we reconvene. And it was good to have you here.
Thank you.